Now, today, here we have a chapter in these pastoral epistles that may contain a couple of beloved verses for some of us here. 2 Timothy feels a bit different from 1 Timothy and Titus. This letter gets more personal, expressing affection between the writer, mentor, and the recipient, mentee. The letter even calls him Timothy, my beloved child. Themes of suffering and shame give poignancy to this letter. And the urgency of passing on encouragement fits with this letter often being seen in the literary genre of a sort of last will and testament. If Paul wrote this, the letter says he was in jail at the time, though scholars aren't too sure how that fits into the timeline. We haven't worried too much in this series about whether Paul really wrote these letters or whether it was someone paying homage to him with that inscription. But as this letter gets more personal and detailed, I'm going to use Paul and Timothy's names to express that close relationship. And Paul wants Timothy to know, God has made you for this. God has been there in the generations before and has given you what you need for whatever is to come. God has made you for this. One of my favorite echoes throughout the stories in the Bible is, be not afraid. And here I hear its companion, be not ashamed. God has made you for this. After his heartfelt greeting, Paul begins by looking into the past. He remembers his own Jewish ancestors who worshiped God with a clear conscience, as he says he himself does. Paul's faith looks different than that of his ancestors, as he has come to believe that God's promises to Israel of a Messiah have become flesh and blood in Jesus. But he honors those ancestors and the relationship with God that they passed on to him so that he might have his eyes open for a Messiah. You might also reflect on how your faith has taken a different shape to that of your parents while still giving thanks for what they passed on to you. Your faith may hold the same name but have been shaped by new experiences. Then, as Paul gives thanks for Timothy's sincere faith, he also remembers Timothy's lineage of faith formation from his grandmother Lois to his mother Eunice. This passing along of faith sets the foundation for Paul to remind Timothy to rekindle the gift of God that he knows is within him. The pastoral epistles are very concerned with sound teaching of the gospel. So Paul reminds Timothy of the people from whom he has received sound teaching and sound faith, strong faith. Faith communities have come to be unique within our culture in the opportunities they give for intergenerational relationships. We can very easily divide ourselves up in the rest of our lives by interest and often by life stage. But in church, we can learn how toddlers to seniors have seen and experienced God. In 1 Timothy 5 and Titus 2, there are longer passages that speak to those intergenerational relationships within the church. Older people are encouraged to be good examples and encouragement to those who are younger, so that the word of God may not be discredited. Younger people are told to live and teach with integrity, so that no opponent can offer any criticism. And across the generations, church members are instructed to speak to each other as father, brother, mother, sister, parents, and siblings in all holiness. Who are the people you remember within the church, within your family, who have passed the faith that lived in them onto you? Can you find in them the encouragement to pass the faith that lives in you onto the next generation? The people who passed faith on to us were not perfect and probably not without doubts or questions. So why are we tempted sometimes to think that we must have it all together before we speak up about the faith that lives in us? Can you trust that God made you for this? The letter goes on. For this reason, because of the faith that lived in Lois, then Eunice, and now lives in Timothy, for this reason I remind you to rekindle the gift of God that is within you through the laying on of my hands. For God did not give us a spirit of cowardice, but rather a spirit of power and of love and of self-discipline. The word that is translated here as self-discipline, you may be interested to know, has the same Greek root as the words that get translated in these letters as modesty for women and sensible, which deacons are to be. So there has been some cherry picking in who gets this sentiment pointed at them. But here, Paul expresses it as a gift from God, a spirit of power and love and of self-discipline or prudence or maybe discernment, we might say. Power and love go hand in hand for this young leader. As N.T. Wright writes, power divorced from love quickly becomes destructive. Love without power can degenerate into wishy-washy sentimentality. And in the midst of that dance of power and love, there is a careful examination of self, reflection before action, discernment before decisions. Paul is telling Timothy that God has given everything needed for the task to which he has been called. What is needed is an indwelling of God's Spirit, a spirit of power and of love and of self-discipline. Because that Spirit is within you, Paul says, do not be ashamed of the message about Jesus or ashamed of me, even though I'm in prison, and that would have been viewed as plenty shameful. Why is Paul not ashamed, even though he's in chains? He writes, for I know the one in whom I have put my trust. If we line up our sense of honor and shame with external social measures, the lines are always changing. For example, you know, I've spent my life on the impossible pursuit of jeans that are long enough for my height because I know that flood pants were laughed at when I was young. But I just saw the other day an advertisement for jeans that are an inch above the ankle, so now apparently they're in style. So that's silly, but that is a picture of us trying to keep up with the measures that are just constantly changing. But Paul writes of honor in relation to God. I am not ashamed, for I know the one in whom I have put my trust, and I am sure that he is able to guard until that day what I have entrusted to him. You'll notice when you read it for yourself an alternate translation in the footnote that is, I am sure that he is able to guard until that day what has been entrusted to me. The good news about Jesus has been entrusted to us. Guard the good treasure entrusted to you, Paul also writes, with the help of the Holy Spirit living in us. Guarding this treasure does not mean locking it unseen into a safe. Guarding the treasure of our faith and of the gospel is seeing that it continues to live in us and in the next person, in the next generation. Guarding our faith calls us to live bravely, without shame in that faith. Though others were avoiding Paul in prison, which is a story that could be written still today, the faith of Onesiphorus called him there to refresh Paul. Onesiphorus knows the one in whom he has put his trust. He has no need to be ashamed. Wherever you are, whatever your calling, can you imagine that God has made you for this? You and the spirit of power and of love and of self-discipline that is within you. What does it mean for you not to be ashamed of the faith that has been passed on to live in you? One of our hang-ups in knowing how to speak and live our faith bravely is often wondering how to do this in the richly diverse world where we find ourselves. How can I be unashamed of my faith, but not arrogant, triumphalistic, or judgmental of other faiths? I think that question is worth talking about as a community, but for starters, I will simply end with telling you a story that graced my inbox this week from Sojourners Magazine. This is a story of power and love and self-discipline and the shameless faith of two people. It's written by Reverend Norman Allen. 800 years ago this fall, in the midst of the Fifth Crusade, Francis of Assisi traveled to the besieged town of Damietta at the mouth of the Nile. Crossing the battle lines, the saint spent 3 days in conversation with Sultan Malik al-Kamil. The two men could not have been more different. The divide between them stretched wide, Christian and Muslim, rich and poor. Christian leaders expected Francis to be martyred, and that this would revive the spirit of the Crusaders. But Francis and al-Kamil found common ground, setting an example 8 centuries ago that we might emulate today. Each man was a person of faith. Each was eager for peace. The Sultan had offered generous treaties only to have them rejected. Francis greeted everyone he met, Pope or Pauper, with the words, "Peace and goodness to you." According to Thomas of Celano, Francis's friend and first biographer, we know that Francis was received very graciously by the Sultan. The details of his days in the enemy camp are slim, but there's much that we can infer. We know that al-Kamil loved a good argument and that he was drawn to the Sufi tradition within Islam. Indeed, Francis would have resembled a Sufi. They, like he, wore rough clothing and avoided personal possessions. I imagine the two men arguing the attributes of Jesus as understood by Sufi Muslims and Franciscan Christians, only to find themselves in agreement, as both faiths emphasize Jesus' rejection of material goods. More important is what we know about the results of their meeting. First, the very fact that Francis returned unharmed is telling. Based on the practices of the time, he would have been beheaded if he'd spoken a word against Islam or the Prophet Muhammad. So Francis must have offered up his own beliefs without denigrating those of the Sultan and his court. This had a direct impact on the Franciscan order. Upon his return to Italy, Francis revises the order's rule and specifies that brothers who live spiritually among the Saracens not engage in arguments or disputes, but be subject to every human creature for God's sake. Second, while in the Sultan's camp, Francis would have heard the call to prayer 5 times each day. Back in Italy, he tries to introduce a similar practice for Christians, saying that they should pause throughout the day to reflect and to worship. Al-Kamil even sends Francis home with an ivory horn meant for this purpose. It's said that Francis used it to gather a crowd before he preached, like the muezzin's call from a minaret. As for al-Kamil, whether it's the influence of Francis or his own Muslim faith, the Sultan proves himself a compassionate ruler. When the Christians finally admit defeat, victims of hunger and bloodshed and death, an eyewitness among them writes, "The Sultan was moved by such compassion that for many days he freely revived and refreshed our whole multitude." This Christian author goes on to say of the Muslim ruler, "Who could doubt that such kindness and mercy proceeded from God?" Reverend Allen concludes his article by suggesting that we might find mentors and role models in a poor monk who preaches peace and a military commander who treasures the wisdom of Sufi poets, in leaders who allow themselves to be transformed by each other.